practice of meditation or practice of yoga implies a context in which they will receive their meaning, a context which may help to understand how they are structured. So the meditation that we are practicing is also included into a context. So a retreat of meditation of 7 days may sometimes appear very long, but if one wants really to understand the context, it may be also very short. That's why in the evening we try to select some of the aspects which are the most important. And sometimes expressing one aspect, it does raise more questions and it's not possible to answer all the questions. The first teacher with whom I studied in Dharamsala was a Tibetan Lama. He himself had studied in Lhasa, in the monastery of Lhasa, and sometimes he would speak about the way he studied. The way they would study in those monasteries would be during the day to receive teaching from their teacher in each class, and then during the evening and sometimes during all the night they will debate among the students, asking questions and answering. And the next day they will have another session of teaching by the teacher and spend the night debating. We'll describe how sometimes during the winter they would put sand around themselves. It was so cold, imagine the winter in Lhasa, in Tibet, how cold it can be. So they would try to get as much sand as they could around themselves, not to feel too cold, and debate all the night. He did study for 30 years. So you may imagine a week is very short to understand the context of our practice. And of course that is true of any tradition. Usually they are very rich, and then understanding, if you want to understand them clearly, it does require time, it does require some determination. So obviously when here we give some aspect of the context, we know very well that some more aspect could be also addressed, some more aspect should be explained. Obviously, if one is speaking about something, then one may wonder, but that does not make sense, it does not seem to, it seems to be contradictory. And then one would need to explain something else in order to understand that aspect. Or if you wish, one should really always have some kind of bracket and say, yes, that means that in this context. And that is difficult to address all the different aspects of the context in which we are practicing. Nevertheless, I will try to explain a few aspects tonight. Again, taking stories from the time of the Buddha. This time, a monk was staying in the monastery where the Buddha was staying, and this monk was a scientist type, very bright, intelligent, having many questions about the universe, about the world. So in his meditation many questions arose, very subtle and deep questions, and he saw that the Buddha never did tell anything about those deep questions, about the universe, if it has limit or no limit, about the beginning and the end of the universe. Very important questions. So he thought, well, I will ask the Buddha then. And if he cannot answer my question, I will leave the monastery. Why should I stay? If he cannot answer, what is the use for me to stay with him? So he went in the evening and asked his question to the Buddha. But the Buddha did not want to answer those questions. He said, although there are opinions about the universe, some opinion that the universe is unlimited. And there are opinions about the universe that the universe is limited. But he said, before anything, there is birth, old age and death. And I am teaching the cessation in this very life. He said, although there are opinions about the universe that it has a beginning, there are opinions that it has an end. But before anything, there is birth, old age and death. And I am teaching their cessation in this very life. So if you want to find answer to your question, you will die before having your answer. Said, I am teaching the Four Noble Truths because they are leading to the cessation of suffering, to freedom. I am not teaching about the universe because they are not leading to the end of suffering, they are not leading to freedom. So he said, remember what I have taught and remember what I have not taught. Pointing out the urgency of some questions and the maybe less importance of some other. Just remind me of a very, very short anecdote that I went through when guiding a tour to Bhutan. Sometimes I've been guiding tourists in India or Bhutan or Tibet, and I was with a group of tourists this time, and we had quite a few problems with airplanes because there was a storm in Bhutan, so we could not fly out. So finally we reached Bombay, everything was fine, so we were supposed to fly to Geneva. It was at the same time of the year, so holiday, there were many people, and I went to get the seat. We were 12, so I was at the desk and discussing with the people there, and behind my back people would come and say, please can I have a window, please can I have a window, and they were asking, requesting seats, and I could see very well that something was wrong at the desk, because actually there was overbooking about 50 people, so many people were just going to get overflowed. So I was not really caring about window seat, I was really caring about getting seats. So I imagine I could have turned to my group of people and make a list of who want a window, who doesn't want a window. And meanwhile, all the seats will have gone. I should say anywhere they went, you know. So we could not take the flight, you know. So you see the question there, which may be so important, interesting, you know, a window seat or no window seat, in this time they were not to the point. So I just was listening to them and saying, well, and I don't want them to understand that something is wrong, because then they want to be helpful in this world. So anyway, we had to spend the night in Bombay Airport, which was not such an interesting adventure. Just to point out that some questions are more important. There is more urgency than some other. And what the Buddha was pointing out in, of course, much deeper way, that before knowing if the universe has a beginning or an end, before that, maybe we may explore our situation. Maybe we may explore our situation of being born, aging and dying. If we can do something about it, that may be more important, more essential than finding out if the universe has a beginning or an end. And also the Buddha said, you will die before the answer. I imagine many generations of people have died and the answer is not yet certain. So the Buddha pointed out the importance of the Four Noble Truths. And in all the Buddhist literature, actually many commentaries are just explaining some aspect of those Four Noble Truths. They are really the essential of the Buddha's teaching. When the Buddha reached awakening in Bodh Gaya, it is said that realizing that it was so subtle, he saw that nobody would understand his teaching. said, well, it's no use for me to try to teach who is going to want to listen to my teaching, who will understand my teaching. Nobody will really understand it. It's too deep and too subtle. And he had decided just to rest and wait till his death, if you wish, and not really starting to teach. According to the story or mythology, it is said that Hindu god Brahma appeared and said, please, please teach, because some people have only little confusion, they will understand your teaching. So for the sake of those few people whose confusion is not too deep, please, they requested him to teach, and he did. So he went, he walked to Varanasi, and the first teaching he gave was the Four Noble Truths. That's really the essence of his teaching, and I'd like to speak about that tonight, about the Four Noble Truths. The first truth is the truth of suffering. And it is quite amazing that the Buddha is starting his first teaching in his quite a vast or deep religion, if you wish, because many followers in so many countries, and a religion should start by suffering, not by something amazing, not by a revelation, not by something fantastic. What he's starting is just by speaking about suffering. Quite a strange beginning. Seems that the Buddha first is describing, looking and trying to understand exactly where he is and where we are. In which earth are we? What is our situation? What is our condition? That's what he wants to understand. In India at this time, 2,500 years ago, there was a lot of speculation. The Indian tradition is very vast, all the Vedas and commentaries. So certainly the Buddha could, and certainly did, study philosophical texts and ritualist texts. But he was not so much interested in that. What he wanted to understand is his own situation. The earth in which he was standing, what was his situation, what was his human condition. So that's where he started his teaching. And what he discovered is not amazing either. He discovered there is birth, and when there is birth, there is aging and death. I imagine many people had observed that before. But he observed it in a way, trying to feel this aspect, birth, old age and death, and all the other aspects which were not satisfactory in a human condition, sense of limitation, frustration, the sense that something is lacking, that our power, our freedom is limited. We cannot just decide, you know, today I would like this kind of temperature, tomorrow I like to have rain. There is some limitation. Of course we may say that our human condition, but that's exactly what the Buddha is questioning. That so many people take for granted, that's fine, we are limited. That's fine, but the Buddha wonder, is this limitation the only thing that there is to human existence? Is this limitation something that we cannot go beyond and that has to be accepted? Is this limitation something that we need to develop resignation towards? Or can we go beyond this limitation? Beyond the limitation of birth, old age and death, beyond the limitation of being fragmented, beyond the limitation of the power of our wishes. As I said, only the temperature or whatever, we certainly would have even better wishes than that, but obviously we are limited. So the Buddha really tried to understand all the aspects of human condition, all the different aspects which are limitation, which were bondage. That's what he wanted to understand, and not accept any resignation. not say that's the way it is. Now let's go back to the origin of the universe and find out. It's more distracting. He really wanted to find a solution to our human condition. Inquiring into our human condition, he tried to see how suffering was coming about, how frustration, limitation was coming about, what was the structure of this limitation, frustration and suffering. And he saw that due to confusion and confused action, there is confusion, confused action that is bringing limitation, that is bringing suffering. Trying to understand deeply how things were moving, were interconnected, he realized that it is because of confusion, because of not understanding where we are, not because not understanding our human condition truly, really, because of this confusion we are limited, because of this confusion there is a lack, because of this confusion we are suffering. He found the causes for our bondage not outside, not in a human condition, not in universal condition. He found the cause of our limitation, the cause of our bondage within ourselves. When finding the cause of our limitation, the cause of our bondage within ourselves, it means that the solution is also within ourselves. If the cause will have been outside, then we should have addressed to the cause outside to find the solution. But since he found the cause inside, confusion, mental state, then he also discovered that the solution will be found within ourselves. We are responsible for our confusion, therefore we also hold the key for the dissolution of confusion, not needing to depend, to require something outside of ourselves. In a sense, the Buddha spent a lot of time describing suffering and the cause of suffering, Second Noble Truth, describing all the interrelation between different aspects. Most of his teaching is describing how we get confused, how from confusion we get to deeper confusion, to frustration, to suffering, which lead to more confused action. Spend a lot of time, a lot of energy describing that. And one may wonder, again, doesn't seem so fascinating for the beginning of such a vast, universal, vast tradition to start with suffering and the origin of suffering being confusion, nothing that one really wants to look for. Now, if we had some friend in jail and we would help them to escape from the jail, it would not be so helpful to describe how beautiful it is outside. Sell by the beach, you can't imagine how it is beautiful nowadays. You know, the water is just perfect, and there are some trees and some flowers. Or in the Negev now, there is full of grass, very nice, with trees and flowers. That would not help so much our friend in jail. He'll say, oh nice, I wish I would be outside. Maybe much more useful to describe, say, okay, your jail is like that, it's made like that. Now you see, you have three doors. The first door open like that, the second open like that, the third open this way. Now you have guards, and the guards usually they change at such a time, and they eat there, and then you have some camera. If you start to describe the jail, then at this time, maybe that could be helpful for the person to escape. Not dreaming about outside. So the Buddha spent a lot of time describing exactly how. And this jail I was taking as an example, there is a difference because the guard and the jail is different from the prisoner. But we are at the same time our own, we are at the same time our own prison, and at the same time we are our own guards. we are constantly building our own jail. So when we understand that we are building our own jail, then maybe we may stop. Maybe we may start to understand that I don't need to put fence all around my sins. So that's why in an important part of Buddha's teaching is describing our own conditioning, all the aspects of our conditioning. From understanding that, from a deep understanding of suffering, deep understanding of our conditioning, source of suffering, then we may, from that understanding, then we may stop to create our own confusion, then we may stop to create our own prison, then we may find freedom. So we explain the third of the noble truths, the truth of the cessation, that when confusion stops, when we stop to build our own prison constantly, when there is no more confusion leading to confused action, at this time, then, as a consequence of that, there will be no arising of suffering, limitation, and frustration. So, as we have seen, since we are the cause of our own frustration and suffering, if we, dealing with this cause, if we can get rid or clear up the confusion, by the clearing of that, we also clear the consequence of this confusion, which is suffering. Therefore, there is an end to suffering, which is arising when there is the end of confusion. And that is within ourselves to deal with that. It is within our own power to clear the confusion which is within ourselves. When there is no more confusion, when there is no more confused action. There is no more suffering, there is no more bondage, and there is freedom. Freedom from birth, old age, and death. According to what the Buddha preached, at least. Freedom from birth, old age, and death. That's what he said to this scientist monk. And this freedom from birth, old age, and death, freedom from confusion, is called nirvana. Sometimes it's called the unconditioned, the unborn. Tradition gives many names to this aspect. The truth of cessation, cessation of suffering, cessation of limitation, cessation of bondage, coming from the cessation of confusion, leading to the cessation of suffering. Now, to clear away confusion, the Buddha taught the fourth noble truth, the truth of the path. The path is the technique, so to speak, helping us to see through the confusion, that we may cease to cultivate confusion and reach freedom. This path is explained in many ways. I will explain it in a triple division, division of morality, concentration, and wisdom. So it's by the cultivation of those three aspects, morality, concentration, and wisdom, that junction of those three qualities will help us to clear away confusion, will help us to reach freedom. What is morality in the Buddhist tradition? It is understood, it's not like a long list of do and don't do that the Buddha would have said, oh, for all my future followers I will give a list of what they should do, what they should not do. It's not this way. The Buddha rather point out to the quality of an action and to the quality of the intention of the action. He said, if any action, any intention, is bringing more confusion and suffering within ourselves and within the other, that is to be avoided. anything bringing more confusion and suffering for oneself and for others, that is to be avoided. Anything leading to less confusion within oneself and within others, and less suffering, that has to be cultivated. Again, maybe he's pointing out, we don't have a list, pointing out to our own responsibility. I'm about to do something. Does it help really to clear away confusion for myself and for the other? Does it not bring more suffering? So we may check if the quality of our being there, the quality of our intention, the quality of our action, which is important. So that for morality, in the context of a retreat, it's expressed sometimes in terms of 5 precepts, I have mentioned the other day, and for us it's some kind of boundaries that we are organizing within our own retreat to protect ourselves, to make our life more simple. So morality is making our life more simple, the retreat for example, that we may then practice meditation with less difficulties, less distraction, less disturbance. Morality in a general sense may be understood as a protection. Let's imagine a samurai. Don't know anything about samurai, but let's imagine a samurai, strong Japanese fighters, skillful, and what we can project anything onto them. So imagine that this strong samurai is walking through Japan, and he's well protected because he's a good samurai. He has all the, what is needed, and he's very well protected. Since he's very well protected, he cannot be defeated because of his protection. He has no weakness, he has no weak spot. Therefore, he can, without fear, he can cross Japan. Now, morality is like the protection of his samurai. I'll explain you why. Let's imagine that I'm lying, telling a wrong story about something. That where I don't respect morality, that where I'm not well protected. That's fine, I'm telling something wrong, but there I can be hit. Because now somebody will discover, then this person may disclose it, and I will be in a difficult situation. So what will I do now? I am in a vulnerable spot. Now, should I tell some more lies? Or what should I do? So morality is also this aspect which make our life that we will be invulnerable because we are well protected. It's not for some kind of beautiful sake, but it's really for the sake that we are in a position that we can always answer to our attitude, we can always answer to our actions. It's very well protected. And you may feel that we observe that sometimes in our daily lives, somebody has told something which is not really true, and then we see the other person coming and starting to wonder, but that doesn't seem to be correct what you said, and we see the person in a bad position, wishing that this person were not here, you know, I wish I were somewhere else. And that's exactly not protected space, because this person has not respect morality. So morality is the sense of being very well protected. Well, I imagine politicians must know that. I mean, so many have been not so well protected, and I imagine they wish they were more or better protected. That's a case where it's very, very obvious. So morality is helping us, is holding our practice together in a protected surrounding. Concentration is a quality of mind that can stay on one object without fluctuation. And we need concentration if we read a novel or if we read the news. If we don't have any concentration, then we can't even read. So we, in our daily life, we need some concentration. If we need to solve some mathematical problem, we need some concentration. To inquire in something, in a sense, much closer to us and much more difficult. To inquire into the truth of birth and death, we need a mind which is even much more stable. The mind should be able to stay with its problems, so to speak, in a much longer sense, with much more stability. If the mind is just resting for a few instants with those questions of birth and death, and then start to go away, to move away, will not be able to understand deeply the truth of birth and death. That's why in meditation we need a state of mind more powerful than we need for reading or for anything else. That's one aspect of the path, concentration. For that, it is thought traditionally to use some, we take one object and we just keep that in mind for as long as possible, and then we bring that back into the mind again and again and again, that the mind may slowly start to settle down and be calm and stable. The object that can be chosen may be a disc, a blue disc, black disc, or white disc, or whatever. There may be an image, like an image of the Buddha. There may be the flame of a candle. There may be the inflow and outflow of breath. There may be a feeling like metta, just keeping that in mind, the stable mind as long as possible. There may be other objects like space. So one can choose, one could choose any of those experiences, objects, to place the mind so that the mind will become quiet and very quiet. And meditators sometimes spend months, very long period of time, just bringing the mind to quietness. My teacher once said, like the stairs going to the airplane, that's concentration. Once you have developed that, then your spiritual path is just traveling like with an airplane. So that's for the development of concentration. And in a sense, it's also a protection. Morality is a social and physical protection, and concentration is like a mental protection, a mental boundary. In concentration, what we do, in fact, we choose one very specific sphere of experience. We could choose that, maybe boring, but we could choose that to concentrate. So we're just looking at that, and that's only experience which will matter for us for the next year. So, black stuff there. What does it mean then? It means that we are, in our perception, in our experiences, we are excluding everything else but that. So it's an exclusion. Just keeping that in mind, looking at it if you wish. It's like we are finding a very precise spot for us to rest, or for our mind to rest. We'll choose to place our mind for the next year only on that. If we were to do that with some success, the mind will become very quiet, very peaceful. There will be no problem. This is not so much a problem. So nothing, no other thoughts, no other perception is arising, therefore no problem is arising. Are you following? There's no thought, no indication, no outer, nothing is coming from outside. The only thing in my experience, only what I'm experiencing for the next year, is just that. The mind becomes very quiet, even certainly due to the quietness, there will be some sense of happiness, of deep inner calm. Now we may understand that this quality of mind may be useful, but I'm not going to develop wisdom. I will not develop wisdom. I'm developing a tool here to get a mind which is very stable. But that does not help for the increase of wisdom. Only if concentration now will be used, let's get to the stairs and the airplane. If there is no airplane, you can go up to the stairs and that's it, you know. So only if now the mind, which is very quiet, we will use it for the development of wisdom, then this powerful tool that has been developed will be able to increase the development of wisdom. The other is really isolating the mind in a very small spot. It's some kind of deep holiday, but in a very small compound. That does not lead to the end of suffering, that does not lead to freedom. That may lead to some experiences of meditation, but not to wisdom, and not to freedom. Why? We have not understood our human condition. It's not by concentration that we understand exactly who we are, that we understand where we are, that we understand our conditioning. Only by this deep understanding of who we are, only by a clear understanding of our conditioning, can then confusion be dispersed, wisdom be developed, and freedom be reached. So now we need to use the stability of our mind to develop wisdom. So concentration is useful only, or developed only for the sake of wisdom. The term vipassana that we are using here to describe the type of meditation we are doing, vipassana means seeing through what? Through our confusion, through our preconception, through our belief in the world. So seeing through, seeing is not only of course with the eyes, but with our wisdom, really being able to go through all the confusion, all the belief that we have, to really understand, know deeply what we are and who we are. And for that, wisdom need to be developed within any of our experiences. When we are sitting, experience may arise, bodily sensation, hearing, seeing, thinking, emotions. We need to understand the nature of each of those experiences. When we understand clearly the nature of each of those experiences, then the confusion that we have about them and about who is experiencing them, this confusion will disappear. And at this time, there will be lack of, or the end of suffering, the end of bondage, and there will be freedom. By the, if you wish, by the intimacy that we are developing with any of our experience at any instant. Within this intimacy, we will see how, understand how, through confusion, we are holding to them in a wrong way, and by this holding, we are creating the bondage. By this intimacy that will be developed in our meditation, then we will stop to grasp to any of our experiences. So if we were to ask, why do we meditate? Technically, if you wish, why should we practice meditation? We practice meditation in order not to grasp. That's the technical aim of our practice of meditation. However we may structure it, however we may organize it, the aim in any Buddhist tradition, and I believe also in many other mystical traditions, is not to grasp. Grasping is the way that we are making the fence to our prison, to our jail. And grasping is when all those, the wall of our prison and the bars of our prison, just collapse. So technically, the reason why we meditate is in order not to grasp. Now, if I am sitting in meditation thinking about the past or about the future, that is grasping. I'm grasping at past thought, I'm grasping at future thought. And because I'm grasping, I don't realize that they don't truly exist, I don't realize their empty nature, and thereby, by this grasping, I am binding myself. So the grasping is what gives solidity to our confusion, grasping, the aspect of our confusion which solidify our bondage. When we come back to the experience, at every instant in our practice, we have been limiting the field of our experiences to bodily sensation, slightly opening to emotions and to hearing, for the sake of simplicity, not because other experiences like thinking or seeing or other should be excluded, just that we try to start as simple as possible. When the mind is quiet enough and when the mind is balanced enough, at this time we don't need to select any field of experience. Then we may be present with hearing, with seeing, with thinking. Doesn't matter if we can keep this quality. Again, just for the sake of simplicity, we are selecting rather awareness to bodily sensations, to emotions, and to hearing as we started today. Now I want to come back to the first story and really hear what the Buddha said. He said to this monk, this scientist monk, he said, well, before anything there is birth, old age and death, and I am teaching their cessation in this very life. So that's what the Buddha said. Teaching the cessation, the end of birth, old age and death. And when the Buddha was 80 years old, as I told you the other night, he died. Now, to this very nice monk, scientist who tried to understand, he is telling him, I am teaching you the cessation of birth, old age and death in this very life. And what he does, a few years later, he dies. It's not a very good example. That way, one may say, there is some kind of contradiction in Buddhist teaching. Saying, I am teaching the end of death, and then he died. Now it seems that, as I said at the beginning, the Buddha inquired into many things that most of the people will take for granted. Most of the people will say, yes, that is our human condition, to be subjected to old age and death. Therefore, we have to do with it. We have to deal with that. We have to accept it. He questioned that. So what did he mean? Obviously, we may say, if something has been born, produced, it will then decay and die. It's not possible that somebody has been born that will not die. Obviously, it will contradict any kind of not deep reasoning. A very simple understanding that if something is produced due to cause and condition, when the cause and condition are changing, then at this time, obviously, person will die. Only somebody, something which is not born, will not die. As soon as somebody, something is born, this thing, this person will die. So only somebody who is not born will not die. So in a sense, what the Buddha meant when he is teaching the end of birth, old age and death, he is teaching that through the practice of the path, we may understand that what we take for ourselves, which has been born, like the body, connected with the body, which is aging and dying, that's not what we are. As long as we identify with that, we are subjected to the condition of the body. So if we believe that we identifying, for example, with the body, different aspect of ourselves, then we will be also subjected to exactly what's happening, therefore aging and dying. When he said, I'm teaching the cessation of birth, we may understand birth in next life, but maybe it's not what he means. He's teaching the cessation of birth, understanding that what we are essentially, what we are truly and deeply, that never was born. What we are really is not somebody or something that took birth. If we realize that, then we will realize that this essence that we are, our true nature, unborn nature, is also not subjected to aging and death. For the body will die, obviously. If we believe we are the body, identifying, obviously we'll suffer. We are suffering the thought, the perspective of the body disappearing. If we realize through the cultivation of the past that our essence, who we are, so to speak really and deeply, this is unborn, this is beyond any concept of being and non-being.